No state may be more politically divided right now than Wisconsin. The discord follows the effort by Republican Governor Scott Walker to eliminate the collective bargaining rights of most public workers there. As NPR's David Shaper reports, the divide is most apparent between Wisconsin's biggest cities and its smallest towns.
Wisconsin is one of those rare states that seems to go back and forth between electing Democrats and Republicans almost every cycle. President Obama won it by a wide margin in 2008. But the state flipped dramatically last year with a near Republican sweep. And last month's state Supreme Court election was so close, votes are still being recounted.
Wisconsin is not just a battleground state. Wisconsin is not just a divided state. But we're literally a 50-50 state.
Mordecai Lee is a professor of governmental affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker.
It's almost like Wisconsin is so evenly split that there must be one little old lady who tilts our elections one way or the other. I mean, that's how close we are. It's just unbelievable.
It's clear Wisconsinites are taking sides, and the battle over collective bargaining in the state that gave birth to the nation's first public unions is hardening their views. University of Wisconsin-Madison political scientist Kathy Kramer-Walsh says voters here have always had their disagreements.
But Wisconsinites in general are good at sort of smoothing over differences and getting along. And right now we're not getting along. And it's blown out into the open. I'd say it's pretty different. It feels very un-Wisconsin-like to me.
Like most states, Walsh says Wisconsin has always had its urban-rural divide. Many in the state's picturesque small towns believe that their tax dollars go to Madison to stay or are diverted to Milwaukee, and they resent it. But add to that now the continuing economic struggles in rural areas as factories shutter and jobs disappear. And Kathy Walsh says there is growing anger with public employees.
Good salaries and benefits and health care in particular is something a lot of people in a lot of places in Wisconsin don't have. And so there's just a lot of resentment towards public employees.
In the small town of Milton near the Illinois border, Ron Soles embodies that resentment.
I think those people are out of touch. Those people in Madison and people that are educated in liberal colleges and our schools are very liberal, and I don't think they're really in touch with the real world.
Even though he's in a union working for the Rock County Rural Electric Co-op, Soule says he and many others here support Governor Walker taking on the public unions.
They expect everybody to get something for nothing, and real conservatives are out working for their wages, working for their benefits. And I get a little tired of paying for everybody else's retirements, too. They need to pay a little bit for themselves, and I think what Scott Walker's doing is absolutely right.
But Richard Edding says he doesn't think people in small towns are all that different from those in Madison. The retired state employee says many here disagree with Walker, and he doesn't care for the governor's autocratic style.
And I think that we have to go back to rule by the people, and we don't have that right now. It's very, very partisan. You're either Republican or you're Democrat, and nobody's talking to each other.
That's a change for Wisconsin, isn't it?
It is. It's a sad change. It's a very sad change. I've lived in Wisconsin all my life, and I used to be really proud of this state.
While many Wisconsin liberals are quick to blame Walker for provoking the bitter collective bargaining fight, conservatives blame the Democratic senators who left the state and the massive protests in Madison for souring things. Regardless of who's to blame, Colleen Varick of Milton says this new divisiveness in Wisconsin has real casualties.
I know my son has a good friend who's very pro-Walker, and the two of them are like, you know, at each other all the time. They just can't talk anymore. They were best man at each other's wedding, and they're having a very difficult time with it.
With the collective bargaining law still in limbo in the courts and recall elections likely against state senators in both parties this summer, this divisive political friction in Wisconsin is only likely to get worse. David Shaper, NPR News.
Now, the U.S. is unlikely to intervene in Syria as it has in Libya, and retired Colonel Douglas McGregor thinks that's a good thing, and not because he opposes democracy, but rather because all these foreign interventions, he says, are too expensive. Now, you've heard it before 1,000 times. The U.S. spends more on defense than the rest of the world combined. Just last year, almost a third of all tax dollars the federal government collected went to the Pentagon. So amid the anxiety over the national debt, Douglas McGregor argues that the military will also have to make sacrifices. He says over 3 years, you could cut the Pentagon's budget by 40%. And he's laid out that plan in the latest issue of Foreign Policy magazine, where he writes that a leaner military wouldn't just be more cost-effective, but also a better fit for America's security interests.
We have this phrase, and I'm sure all of your listeners have heard it, war of choice, the emphasis on choice. If you look at all of the interventions that we have launched since 1945, beginning with Vietnam in 1965 and moving forward, none of them have changed the international system at all. And none of them have directly benefited us strategically. The last military event that had a true strategic impact on the international system was the Second World War. So Americans need to understand that these wars of choice, these interventions of choice, have been both unnecessary, counterproductive, strategically self-defeating, and infinitely too expensive for what we can actually afford.
What happens? I mean, you're essentially saying you've got to starve the beast here.
Yes.
You've got to turn off the taps.
Yes.
So in 3 years' time, a 40% reduction, you're saying the Pentagon is just going to have to adapt to that, and it's going to force them to do
yes.
it.
All positive military change. If you look at the Soviet state, if you look at Nazi Germany, if you go back before the First World War and look at the Royal Navy and the British Army, the various military formations over the 19th and 20th centuries, what you discover is that the most innovation and the most positive change and adaptation to reality occurs not in a flood of money, but in its absence. That's when people have to sit down and come to terms with reality and realize that they cannot go on into the future and do what they've done in the past.
Okay, the U.S. is expected to spend about $700 billion on defense this year. You're saying immediately you can cut about $300 billion out of that. Where would you actually cut the money?
Well, first of all, you have a very bloated force structure. We have over 1,500 flag officers. We have
talking about generals and
generals
admirals.
And admirals, that's right. And we have enormous numbers of single service headquarters, and we have multiple regional unified commands. These are the combatant commands that emerged in the 1980s, largely in response to a Soviet empire that was already on the decline. We don't need all of those headquarters. We don't need all of those commands, and they cost billions of dollars. No one has come forward and admitted that for the last 10 years, I would argue certainly since 1991, we have faced the weakest adversaries that we have ever encountered in the history of this country. Now, what do I mean by that? You're talking about people with no armies, no air forces, no air defenses, no naval capability. You come to terms with the reality that the nature of warfare has changed, that technology, new technologies, new organizations, new force structures, new force designs allow you to do things differently and more cheaply.
But in virtually every congressional district, there is some component built or created that is for the defense industry. It employs many, many, many thousands of people all across this country. So realistically, how do you think that your plan would ever be implemented?
Well, I think the plan can be implemented when people come to terms with an understanding that we have to deliver the services that were promised under Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Mm-hmm. We cannot honor those obligations and do so without reducing defense and reorienting our defense posture to a world that's very different today from the one in which most of these forces were created and invented. And what we have right now are very powerful military bureaucracies tied to the defense industries that want to stay in business that are, quite frankly, larger than we need. And we have congressional interests that want to sustain prosperity at home and see the military budget as a way to cultivate prosperity by redistributing income. This is an enormous problem, but we've got to deal with it because we can't afford it, and it will ultimately consume us over time.
That's Douglas McGregor. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel. He recently wrote about this subject for Foreign Policy magazine. The article is called Lean, Mean Fighting Machine. His latest book is called Warrior's Rage. Douglas McGregor, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Every few years, sometimes months, since 1917, Congress has voted to raise the debt ceiling. This is basically the maximum amount of money it allows the federal government to borrow. And right now, that number is $14.3 trillion. And the Treasury Department says we're getting very close to hitting that limit. Now, Congress has always voted to increase the ceiling every time the feds get close. But this time it's different. When Congress reconvenes on Monday, several Republican lawmakers and even some Democrats say they won't let it happen. But why? Debt limits and consequences? That's our cover story today. So how did we get here? Well, it starts during the Revolutionary War.
America is born as a country highly indebted.
That's Simon Johnson. He's an economist at MIT. The revolution, he explains, was financed by debt.
Partly by borrowing from the French and partly by borrowing from the Dutch in order to buy weapons from them. Now, those debts were very mixed up. They were state level. They were currency that had just been issued. It was Alexander Hamilton who had the, some people would say brilliant, some people would say problematic idea of consolidating this all and creating a national debt.
And how much?
In 1792, I'm looking at it, $80 million.
$80 million
was a lot of money back then. Look, the prevailing philosophy of the day was that government debt was something you should incur only in an emergency like a big war. Mm. Of course, there was the War of Independence. Then there was the War of 1812. But after those wars, there was a determined effort by everybody, really, in political life to pay the debt down. And Andrew Jackson came in partly determined to really see the debt off the scene once and for all.
Andrew Jackson, the president who inherited a debt of $58 million and took it down to just $33,000.
Well, that was Jackson, and Jackson was determined to get rid of the debt.
If the debt was $33,000 today, I would volunteer my entire net worth to single-handedly pay it off. I would do that as a patriot.
And I'm sure that you would be elected to high office on that basis. But in getting rid of the debt, or certainly as part of what happened to the economy at that time, the economy slowed down. There was a big depression, and that undermined revenue, so the debt starts to go back up again.
From then on, the debt becomes this big rolling wave, up, down, but mostly up. And by the middle of the Civil War, it tops $1 billion for the first time.
The success of the North was based in part on its ability to borrow.
Now, fast forward to 1917. In 2 years,
all of a sudden,
the debt jumps almost $20 billion.
The U.S. goes into the war and sends a big army to Europe. This is extremely expensive.
And by the end of World War II, it's almost $260 billion.
That's a staggering number, and that's a tough number to get out of. But after Vietnam, and with the disruptions of the 1970s, we turn some sort of corner. This appropriation process goes way off track.
So under President Reagan, the debt tops $1 trillion. But the numbers really take off under President George W. Bush.
It was partly tax cuts, with the belief that if you cut taxes, you get an economic boom.
$5 trillion when he takes office in 2000.
It was partly war.
$10 trillion by the end of George W. Bush's presidency.
Those are expensive.
And under President Obama?
And of course, it was the recession.
$4 trillion more in just 2 years.
Most of this swing in the debt is caused by the slowdown, caused by the loss of tax revenue.
Which brings us to today, a $14 trillion debt. Now, depending on how you calculate it, anywhere between 75 and 90% of America's total economic output.
Well, it's not particularly sustainable. The bet, if you like, is that we can pay it off over time. If you believe the U.S. remains a dynamic economy, we're going to find our way to new products and new ideas and figure out how to turn those into money and pay some revenue to the government on the back of that, then we will be okay. If you think, however, that we're going to hit stagnation, or if you think the foreigners are going to want their money back quickly, then we're going to have a much bigger problem.
Economist Simon Johnson. So if the government is simply allowed to borrow more and more each year, what's the point of asking Congress to set a limit on it at all? We asked Maya McGinnis. She's the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation.
Basically, it's served for quite some time now as a speed bump along the road, which just means government stops, looks at what it's doing and says, okay, we're going to borrow some more,
right,
and they approve a limit, increase.
And so over the years and over the decades, it's become kind of this simple procedure. Congress continues to approve increasing the debt ceiling. I read since 1962 they've done this 74 times. In the last 10 years alone, they've raised the debt ceiling 10 times. So traditionally, it has not been a big deal, right? Congress just says, all right, we're getting close to the debt ceiling. Let's raise what the government's allowed to borrow.
That's right. It's not something that we usually do a whole lot of brinkmanship over, and it doesn't go to the last minute. But it is an excuse where politicians will go to the floor, give heartfelt speeches about the need not to borrow so much and burden the future generation, all things which I think are reasonably good points, then go ahead, lift the debt ceiling, and borrow some more.
In the past, we have had depressions, we've had a civil war, we had World War II. How is it that we are in a worse position with respect to the debt now than at almost any other time in our history?
Well, we've gone through periods where the debt has gone up, And we've also gone through periods where the debt has gone down in the past. So we would go into a war and you would borrow a lot, or a national emergency or an economic downturn. Borrowing would go up significantly. But then when you came out of it, we would start to close that gap. We would pay some of that debt down. Unfortunately, we've lost that side of the equation in recent years.
Why?
I think there's just a lack of fiscal discipline, where we now have a desire, a very strong desire, driven by politics in many ways, for more spending, less taxes, not making kind of the hard choices of, if you want to spend something, how are we going to pay for it? And because the culture of deficits has become permissible, it's become something that politicians of both parties use regularly to help fill in the gaps in their budget. The debt just keeps piling up. And I think people are worried about stepping forward with the real ways to change or put forth the policies that would take us off this track, because they think they'll get beaten up for making hard political choices. So we continue to deficit finance.
Now, as you know, Congress has always approved a raising the debt ceiling. We are very close, according to the Treasury Department, to hitting the debt ceiling now. I think it's about $14.3 trillion. That is the amount of money Congress has allowed the government to spend. Many members of Congress, most of them Republicans, are threatening not to allow this to happen. I want to talk to you more about some of the potential consequences of that debt ceiling not being raised in a moment. But first, I want you to hear a conversation I just had with Senator Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah. He is one of the most vocal opponents of allowing the debt ceiling to be raised. Here it is.
We're spending money that we do not have. We're borrowing from our children and our grandchildren, some of whom are not yet born. And that doesn't feel right to me, especially when we're being asked to increase the debt ceiling without putting in place any kind of mechanism to make sure that we eventually stop doing this.
Now, if the debt ceiling is not raised, as you know, the Treasury Department is warning that it will cripple our economy, that the U.S. will essentially do what it has never done. It will default on its loans.
I would think, and I would hope, and I'm trying to legislate in such a way so that the Secretary of the Treasury would make sure that the very first payments made with the very first money in the door each month would go to pay the interest on our existing national debt. I know of no reason why he wouldn't do that, and I find it strange that that threat is made.
But why would countries be willing to buy U.S. Treasury bonds if there was a threat that, even if it would only be temporary, but there'd be a threat that they would become worthless?
Well, that's precisely the question I ask, which is, if we continue to issue debt at the rate that we're now issuing it, at some point in the very near future, those who buy our debt are understandably going to grow a little bit antsy about the pace at which we're accumulating new debt. And they're going to start wondering whether or not it's worth the investment, whether or not this is a safe investment. And so it is not the case that there is danger on one side but not the other. Any direction in which we step here is fraught with danger. And so what I'm saying is, before we take that next step and just blindly increase the debt limit, we ought to look seriously at reforming the way in which we spend money, at putting in place a balanced budget amendment so as to require Congress to change how it spends, so that it's not this reflexive impulse to just raise the debt ceiling again and again and again until we get to the point where we can't get anyone to buy our debt.
And with me once again here in the studio is Maya McGinnis, the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation. And Maya, he's saying at some point you've got to turn off the taps. You cannot continue to give the government the opportunity to borrow and borrow and borrow. Most people in this country don't operate their own households like that. The government can't be allowed to do that. What could the consequences be of not allowing the debt ceiling to rise?
Well, listen, I completely share the concern that if we continue to borrow, this is a terrible situation for the country, and what we're doing right now is the wrong fiscal course to be on. But I don't at all share his confidence that if we didn't lift the debt ceiling, we wouldn't have a default. So there are a lot of complicated factors in how you pay money if you haven't increased the debt ceiling. And these are the kind of complications you don't want to throw into already jittery debt markets.
Break it down. I mean, when you say default, what does that mean? Does that mean that all of a sudden China can't collect on its debt and other countries? And what does that actually mean for our economy?
Right. So we've issued all these treasuries, bills, bonds, and notes, and we owe interest on them. And so if you don't pay your interest, that would be a default. And so one of the issues is, could we prioritize that interest? Could we pay the money that we owe in the bonds but not pay our money to our troops or Social Security recipients? And then you have a whole political discussion of how's that going to fly if you're sending the money to China but you're not sending it to your own retirees. There is a question of whether you could prioritize it, but it's complicated because the timing of when money comes into the government and when it goes out is not completely under our control. And so we still might end up defaulting. And if we turn into deadbeat USA, that just changes the whole way our system works. We would not be able to borrow on the same terms again. Interest rates would shoot up, and that would have an effect on the rest of the economy, and it would likely put us back into a recession. I think that's not unlikely at all. At the same time, we shouldn't just lift the debt ceiling and say, oh, we'll figure all this out tomorrow. We should attach to that some reasonable changes, some savings, some budgetary mechanisms to get us on the right path. And this should be the speed bump that makes us change our ways.
That's Maya McGinnis. She's the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation. Maya, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, thank you very much.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to switch gears now from international news and talk about an issue closer to home. We're going to talk about small businesses. In a few minutes, did you ever dream of owning a Korean deli, working back-breaking hours for not a lot of cash? No, you say? Neither did writer Ben Ryder Howe, but he did it anyway, all for the love of his Korean-American wife and in-laws. We'll find out about some of his adventures a little later in the program. And this matters because it's a cliche that happens to be true. Small businesses are the engine of the economy. And Bloomberg Businessweek recently reported that small business owners are more pessimistic about their futures, while the people who run large companies are now more optimistic about the potential for future growth. We wanted to know what was behind these contrasting opinions and what things small businesses might want to consider right now in order to survive. So we've called upon our regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy, our money coach, Alvin Hall. Alvin, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here to talk about this subject.
Well, you know, you actually also are a small business owner yourself.
Yes, I am. I own a consulting business, and we design training programs about the financial markets.
So a number of indexes, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, Small Business Optimism Index, and a number of other surveys of this type all seem to report the same thing, that their small business owners' sense of optimism about the economy and about their futures has fallen in this last quarter from the beginning of the year. Why might that be?
I think there has been no pickup in sales for small businesses. I know, speaking for myself and for my friends who I talked to yesterday about their sales, they've all seen sales either go down slightly or stay flat. So that sort of sucks some of the optimism out of them. Also, you find that it can be either very industry specific or specific to your local economy. And in some cases, some businesses are picking up a little bit, but most of them are staying flat because people are simply not spending money.
But, you know, small business owners, according to a number of surveys, the small business owners say that they plan to increase their selling prices, but they realize that that's not going to last. Why would they be increasing their prices at a time like this when people still aren't buying?
Two things have happened. One, they've seen the costs of certain goods and services go up, such as gasoline. So if your services are dependent upon that, you're going to have to knock them up. Also, the other issue is that inventories have shrunk. If you are a person who's delivering a certain type of good, a widget, say, or trying to sell that widget on, and once the inventories shrink, you can raise the prices a bit. But everyone knows that as soon as supplies go up again, your customers will say, well, can I get a better deal? Because they're monitoring that supply chain also. So they probably will not be able to sustain those price increases.
One of the other issues that small business owners seem to be talking a lot about is the access to credit. And
yes,
that, and even though the spigots seem to be opening for large companies, small business owners are still reporting that they're having a very hard time getting access to credit. Do you think that that's, is that an experience you've had, and why is that?
That's an experience that my best friend has had. He runs a small business out of Greenwich, Connecticut, and he has been applying for loans because they use part of the loan to subsidize the business, provide them with working capital from week to week or month to month. And they found getting the loan more and more difficult. They saw certain credit cards cancel. They saw certain credit lines cut. So they don't feel that the banks are on their side. So what he and his partner have been doing, they've gone from one bank to another until they were able to locate a bank bank that would understand their business and try to help them get the financing that they need. So I think people need to start thinking outside of that traditional bank where you may have had that relationship for years and years and years. You may now need to start shopping around because maybe there's another entity out there that will listen a bit more.
Well, it wasn't a loan shark, was it?
No, he did not go to a loan shark.
So we don't have to worry about his kneecaps, do we?
No. He went to a traditional bank. But that's interesting about the loan shark. Another friend of mine started an art gallery, and she was having a hard time getting financing for that. So she went online and found a service where people were willing to fund some young businesses.
Well, this is always the big sort of question at a time like this. Expand or scale back? For example, if you owned a coffee shop, does it make more sense? Or if you're a breakfast spot, does it make sense to, you know, try to offer lunch now? Or scale back and maybe cut the number of products that you offer and focus just on the few things that you do, like really great coffee? What's your advice at a time like this?
I think that if you believe in your business and you've done your research very well and you know realistically when your business is likely to become profitable, it can still be a good time to start a business. In my neighborhood here in Manhattan, two blocks from where I live, there was a shop that was empty. And we noticed that this little sandwich shop was going in there selling croissant, brioche, sandwiches in the middle of the day, and then entrees in the early evening. At lunchtime the other day, there were 24 people, I counted, coming out of the door waiting to go in. There are four other sandwich shops within five or six doors from there, but this one has somehow captured the idea, and people are talking about how good the croissants are, how good the coffee is there. Is it because it's new? I don't know. But nonetheless, this guy, I talked to him, he said, when we opened the business, we thought we'd get a lot of traffic here because of the neighborhood, and maybe the neighborhood was looking for something fresh and new. So if you have a good strategy, you know how long it will take you to turn a reasonable profit, and you have enough of a safety net to carry your business to that period of time, then it could be a good time to start a business.
Alvin Hall is our regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy, our money coach, and he was kind enough to join us once again from our studios in New York. Alvin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.